The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our program is designed for people learning English. We speak slowly, using simple grammar and a limited vocabulary.
Today, we have a report from Dan Friedel, and John Russell brings us Ask a Teacher. We close the show with An American Story. But first, Dan Novak and I talk about a new movie.
Lin-Manuel Miranda began writing what would become In the Heights as a university student. The musical play would launch him as a playwright and performer. Now, 20 years later, a movie version is in theaters for its first weekend. Miranda said, like other artists, he was driven by ambition, but also by something else. It was a lot of fear, honestly, Miranda said in a recent interview. I was 18, 19, and starting to study theater. The fear was, I'm going into a field that has no space for me, that has no roles for me. It was sort of that thing of, no one's going to write your dream show. In the Heights opened on June 10th. It celebrates many things. The Latino immigrant experience, neighborhood communities in New York City, and life itself.
The movie was supposed to be released last June, but was delayed by the coronavirus health crisis. The film's director, however, thinks the delay was not necessarily a bad thing. Moviegoers might be ready for some energetic music, singing, and dancing after a year of restricted life. In the Heights director John M. Chu calls the movie a vaccine of joy. On the first day of shooting, we all got in a circle, and I was like, let go of all the pressure. Let's just entertain these people, Chu remembers. On Wednesday, In the Heights played at the Tribeca Film Festival with showings across New York City. It has won praise from critics. The filmmakers hope In the Heights can be for Latinos what Black Panther was for Black Americans, and what Crazy Rich Asians was for Asian Americans. Hispanics are the largest minority in the United States. They make up an even larger percentage of moviegoers. But the minority is underrepresented in Hollywood productions. Chu said, in the end, it is moviegoers who decide. Crazy Rich Asians, which Chu also directed, was a surprise pop culture hit that led to changes in the movie industry.
In the Heights tells a story about a Dominican-American store owner, Usnavi, who dreams of returning to the Caribbean area. Miranda himself played Usnavi in the theater version. Actor Anthony Ramos, a native of New York City's Bushwick area, performs the part in the movie. Ramos said he experienced many of the things shown in the movie. There are shots of the food that I grew up eating, the music that I grew up listening to, he said. A sense of responsibility weighed on Ramos during the filming in Washington Heights. Before shooting, Ramos would shout to the crew, "For the culture," a custom he learned from director Spike Lee while working on one of his movies. It meant that we are all here in this moment doing this film and telling this story for something that is way bigger than any of us, said Ramos. This is for everybody who had to sacrifice, who had to break doors open. Many performers involved in the first In the Heights Broadway show appear in the movies Final Song and Dance. Students from a nearby high school also can be seen in the film. The students had produced their own In the Heights show, which the filmmakers watched and found moving. It showed us, "This is what we're here for," said Chu.
Others starring in the movie include Leslie Grace as Nina Rosario, a college student home for the summer. Corey Hawkins as Benny, a taxi driver. And Melissa Barrera as Vanessa, a beauty salon worker trying to get her own home. 30-year-old Barrera said the part she plays as a young woman seeking a better future away from home is basically herself. Barrera was born in Mexico. "I feel like I've worked really hard in my career, but there's always something like, what is it that I'm missing?" said Barrera. "I was that girl. I left Mexico. I knew I wasn't going to be able to become a performer in my hometown." When the film was early in development, there was an interest in getting famous singers to play some parts. But Miranda strongly believed that In the Heights should help grow the Latino stars the industry has been lacking. The creators also decided to include some current issues in the story. "Once we decided on Now, there was a lot of room to grow," said Kiara Alegria Udes. She wrote the screenplay and, earlier, the book for the theater production. "I live in Washington Heights. Part of how I write is just by walking around and listening." Miranda has seen many changes since the first 2008 Broadway performance. He noted that theater attendance numbers for Latinos went up in 2008, the year his musical opened on Broadway. Then, he said, the numbers decreased. "In a lot of ways, time has caught up to In the Heights," Miranda said. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Novak.
Scientists near San Francisco work to identify a type of endangered fish using a tool that was originally made for treating cancer. A special machine called Sherlock uses technology that started with CRISPR. CRISPR is a tool that is able to change the genetic material in specific cells. The technology is now used to change the structure of immune cells so they can recognize and fight cancer. The same technology is used in Sherlock. Sherlock, of course, is named after the famous investigator Sherlock Holmes. They do not, however, use Sherlock to change fish cells. Instead, the ocean researchers catch the fish, collect a small amount of mucus, and then test the cells to find the genetic makeup of the fish. It can be done in about 30 minutes. In the past, the researchers would have to wait weeks or months to get test results. The technology is extremely helpful when looking at different species of Chinook salmon because they look nearly the same. However, some of them are endangered, and the scientists need to keep track of them. Andrea Schreier is an associate professor at the University of California in Davis. She wrote a paper published in the journal Molecular Ecology Resources about a similar project with a different kind of fish known as smelt. Now she is working on the salmon. In the past, the scientists would catch the Chinook salmon and measure them to tell them apart. "It's not very accurate," she said. Schreier said when she and her team catch the fish, the Sherlock machine is able to quickly tell them if they have one of the special salmon. It's important because it allows the scientists to do things that will help the endangered salmon live longer. For example, they can catch them in lakes far away from the coast and take them by truck to the San Francisco Bay. In the past, the fish might have tried to make it to the bay by swimming in rivers. However, due to climate change, the river water is sometimes too warm for the fish to make the trip safely. Schreier said she feels good about the project because she likes being able to assist with conservation.
I really want to work to, you know, maintain our ecosystems and our native populations as much as possible, given all of the pressures that we humans place on them through our different activities.
Melinda Bearwald is an environmental program manager with the California Department of Water Resources. She also is working on the study. She said the work the team is doing on getting information about the fish is just one example of how new information about genetics will help people who do work like hers.
The power of genetics is now unlocked for other people to be able to use. And that's one of the big things that I think is changing how we're going to use this in our area for monitoring.
I'm Dan Friedel.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Tui Duong Li, who writes, "What is the difference between finally, eventually, and ultimately?" Dear Tui, thank you for your question. It centers on three words that act as adverbs. Adverbs can change the meaning of a verb, adjective, another adverb, or even a whole sentence. Finally, eventually, and ultimately generally show time. They often suggest the idea of a later time or the end of a period of time. In some cases, they are very close in meaning. But there are some differences in the ways that English speakers use these terms. Let's explore a few of them. Finally is often used to introduce the last in a series of statements. When used in this way, finally is especially common in speeches, presentations, or in formal writing, such as in an academic paper or a job application. For example, a person might end a presentation by saying,
"Finally, I'd like to thank the conference organizers for putting together this event."
Eventually means at some later time or in the end. It can be used to talk about something that will happen in the future. For example, you might hear a basketball fan say,
"The Celtics have some good young players. In a few years, they'll eventually win the championship."
Or you might hear a gardener talk about a tree that will grow to a tall height As in?
This tree will eventually reach a height of 50 meters.
Ultimately can mean in the most important way, or at the most basic level. When it has this meaning, speakers often use it at the beginning or in the middle of a sentence, as in,
ultimately, it is a question for the voters to decide. It is ultimately a question for the voters to decide.
The next time you read in English or listen to English speakers, try to pay careful attention to words such as finally, eventually, and ultimately. Over time, you will notice regular ways that speakers use these terms. With hard work and careful study, you will eventually understand how to use these terms with ease. If you have a question for our staff of teachers, send it by email to learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm John Russell.
Now it's time for An American Story. Shep O'Neill narrates The Ransom of Red Chief by O. Henry.
It looked like a good thing. But wait till I tell you. We were down south in Alabama, Bill Driscoll and myself, when this kidnapping idea struck us. There was a town down there as flat as a pancake and called Summit. Bill and I had about $600. We needed just $2,000 more for an illegal land deal in Illinois. We chose for our victim the only child of an influential citizen named Ebenezer Dorset. He was a boy of 10, with red hair. Bill and I thought that Ebenezer would pay a ransom of $2,000 to get his boy back, but wait till I tell you. About 2 miles from Summit was a little mountain covered with cedar trees. There was an opening on the back of the mountain. We stored our supplies in that cave. One night, we drove a horse and carriage past old Dorset's house. The boy was in the street throwing rocks at a cat on the opposite fence. "Hey, little boy," says Bill, "would you like to have a bag of candy and a nice ride?" The boy hits Bill directly in the eye with a piece of rock. That boy put up a fight like a wild animal, but at last we got him down in the bottom of the carriage and drove away. We took him up to the cave. The boy had 2 large bird feathers stuck in his hair. He points a stick at me and says, "Ha, paleface, do you dare to enter the camp of Red Chief, the terror of the plains?"
"He's all right now," says Bill, rolling up his pants and examining wounds on his legs. "We're playing Indian. I'm old Hank, the trapper, Red Chief's captive. I'm going to be scalped at daybreak by Geronimo. That kid can kick hard." "Red Chief," says I to the boy, "would you like to go home?"
"Ah, what for?" says he. "I don't have any fun at home. I hate to go to school. I like to camp out. You won't take me back home again, will you?"
"Not right away," says I. "We'll stay here in the cave for a while."
"All right," says he. "That'll be fine. I never had such fun in all my life."
We went to bed about 11 o'clock. Just at daybreak, I was awakened by a series of
terrible screams from Bill. Red Chief was sitting on Bill's chest with one hand holding his hair. In the other, he had a sharp knife. He was attempting to cut off the top of Bill's head based on what he had declared the night before. I got the knife away from the boy, but after that event, Bill's spirit was broken. He lay down, but he never closed an eye again in sleep as long as that boy was with us.
"Do you think anybody will pay out money to get a little imp like that back home?" Bill asked.
"Sure," I said. "A boy like that is just the kind parents love. Now, you and the chief get up and make something to eat while I go up on the top of this mountain and look around." I climbed to the top of the mountain. Over toward summit, I expected to see the men of the village searching the countryside, but all was peaceful. "Perhaps," says I to myself, "it has not yet been discovered that the wolves have taken the lamb from the fold." I went back down the mountain. When I got to the cave, I found Bill backed up against the side of it. He was breathing hard, with the boy threatening to strike him with a rock.
"He put a red-hot potato down my back," explained Bill, "and then crushed it with his foot. I hit his ears. Have you got a gun with you, Sam?"
I took the rock away from the boy and ended the argument.
"I'll fix you," says the boy to Bill. "No man ever yet struck the Red Chief but what he got paid for it. You better be careful."
After eating, the boy takes a leather object with strings tied around it from his clothes and goes outside the cave, unwinding it. Then we heard a kind of shout. It was Red Chief holding a sling in one hand. He moved it faster and faster around his head. Just then I heard a heavy sound and a deep breath from Bill. A rock, the size of an egg, had hit him just behind his left ear. Bill fell in the fire across the frying pan of hot water for washing the dishes. I pulled him out and poured cold water on his head for half an hour. Then I went out and caught that boy and shook him. "If your behavior doesn't improve," says I, "I'll take you straight home. Now, are you going to be good or not?"
"I was only funnin'," says he. "I didn't mean to hurt old Hank, but what did he hit me for? I'll behave if you don't send me home."
I thought it best to send a letter to old man Dorset that day, demanding the ransom and telling how it should be paid. The letter said, "We have your boy hidden in a place far from Summit. We demand $1,500 for his return. The money to be left at midnight tonight at the same place and in the same box as your answer. If you agree to these terms, send the answer in writing by a messenger tonight at 8:30. After crossing Owl Creek, on the road to Poplar Cove, there are 3 large trees. At the bottom of the fence, opposite the 3rd tree, will be a small box. The messenger will place the answer in this box and return immediately to Summit. If you fail to agree to our demand, you will never see your boy again. If
You pay the money, as demanded. He will be returned to you safe and well within 3 hours.
I took the letter and walked over to Poplar Cove. I then sat around the post office and store. An old man there says he hears Summit is all worried because of Ebenezer Dorset's boy having been lost or stolen. That was all I wanted to know. I mailed my letter and left. The postmaster said the mail carrier would come by in an hour to take the mail on to Summit. At 8:30, I was up in the third tree, waiting for the messenger to arrive. Exactly on time, a half-grown boy rides up the road on a bicycle. He finds the box at the foot of the fence. He puts a folded piece of paper into it and leaves, turning back toward Summit. I slid down the tree, got the note, and was back at the cave in a half hour. I opened the note and read it to Bill. This is what it said. Gentlemen, I received your letter about the ransom you ask for the return of my son. I think you're a little high in your demands. I hereby make you a counterproposal, which I believe you will accept. You bring Johnny home and pay me $250, and I agree to take him off your hands. You had better come at night, because the neighbors believe he is lost, and I could not be responsible for what they would do to anybody they saw bringing him back. Very respectfully, Ebenezer Dorset.
Great pirates of Penzance, says I, of all the nerve.
But I looked at Bill and stopped. He had the most appealing look in his eyes I ever saw on the face of a dumb or talking animal. Sam, says he, what's $250 after all? We've got the money. One more night of this boy will drive me crazy. I think Mr. Dorset is making us a good offer. You aren't going to let the chance go, are you?
Tell you the truth, Bill, says I. This little lamb has got on my nerves, too.
We'll take him home, pay the ransom, and make our getaway. We took him home that night. We got him to go by telling him that his father had bought him a gun and we were going to hunt bears the next day. It was 12 o'clock when we knocked on Ebenezer's front door. Bill counted out $250 into Dorset's hand. When the boy learned we were planning to leave him at home, he started to cry loudly and held himself as tight as he could to Bill's leg. His father pulled him away, slowly.
How long can you hold him? Asked Bill.
I'm not as strong as I used to be, says old Dorset.
But I think I can promise you 10 minutes.
Enough, says Bill. In 10 minutes, I shall cross the central, southern, and middle western states and be running for the Canadian border.
And as dark as it was, and as fat as Bill was, and as good a runner as I am, he was a good mile and a half out of Summit before I could catch up with him.
And that's our show. But we'll be back tomorrow with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Katie Weaver.